Now, so welcome everybody to this week's Sutta class. This week, talking about the Ambalatika Ra Uhuluvada Sutta, the advice to Rahula at Ambalatika. I'm not sure how long this class will take. If it's only takes a short time, we might move on to the next discourse as well. But we'll see how that goes.
Could you just do it again? Ambalatika
Rahulovada Sutta. Lakti. 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 Not entirely like latte. No. Anyway, this particular one. Oops. It's interesting. Something wrong with... Okay, this particular sutta... Unfortunately, I can't find a study by Venerable Inalio on this one. I must have misplaced it somewhere. It has quite a few parallel versions, as you can see. Madhyama Agama is in the MA 14 is obviously in the Madhyama Agama, which is the most common place to have a parallel. But then all these other ones in other places. These two are in the Vinaya, that one I think is in the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not quite sure, partial parallel. These guys look like independent suttas, T211 and T212 look like they're independent suttas. And then these ones, T1442 and 1509, are either the Vinaya or Vinaya-related texts, I believe. I'm not so sure about this one. Sanskrit fragment. Some kind, and also found in the Tibetan, and here in the Tibetan Vinaya, Luba. So what that means is because the story of the Buddha's life, the Buddha's biography, is included as is a major section of the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya. So the whole Buddha biography gets put in there, and so a lot of the suttas, which in the Pali, where you find scattered here and there bits of episodes of human interest. Kind of the family soap opera side of Buddhism, those things get put into, you know, it's like, you are my son, Luke, these kinds of things. These kinds of moments are all found in the Mula Sarvastivada. In Pali, they're here and there, and in the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya, they get them and put them all together in one section, okay? Which is lucky for us, because it means that there is kind of a fairly substantial body of important suttas there, and of course unlucky for us, we haven't got the actual study here right now and we can't read Tibetan, so at least we know it's there, so that's something. Okay, now this particular story about Rahula. Now Rahula, as usual, we have the what we all know about Rahula, right? On the one hand, on the other hand, we have the facts. And as not uncommonly, when we come to Buddhism, when we start to look closely at this situation, we start to realize that what we know, or what we think we know about Rahula, is a big pile of things, and what the actual facts are is a vanishing little, disappearing little droplet in here. And we begin to think, oh, what's actually going on? So first of all, Rahu's name. Everybody knows Rahu means feta, doesn't it?
No.
Doesn't everybody know that? Yeah, Nadia knows that. Well, you have to unknow it now, okay?
Why would you call your son feta?
Because he said, because he was going to leave home.
And Rahu is the son.
Right, but that's
another thing. We'll get to that later.
We'll get to that in a minute, right? Rahu means feta. But of course, Rahu doesn't mean feta, and there's nowhere where Rahu actually means feta. It seems to have been entirely invented to explain his name, and it's in the story. And more likely, he's named Rahula after Rahu, the Asura demon who eats the sun. Okay, and quite possibly he might have been, for example, born on the night of a lunar eclipse or something like that. And so that might explain it. I'm not sure about that particular detail, but in any case.
But then they would have said that Buddha left on the night of the solar eclipse, because they say he left the night he was born.
If he left on the night of the solar eclipse.
Well, because it says that Rahula.
Solar eclipses typically don't happen at night time.
Well,
that's maybe why they didn't do that.
It says here that Rahula was born the day Buddha left.
Right, we'll come on to that in a moment.
So your eclipse would have happened.
Rahu. So then we have to understand who's Rahu. Rahu is an Asura chieftain. The Samyutta Nikaya says that on one occasion when he sees Chandima and Surya, both of these invoked the aid of the Buddha. An interesting little difference between those two is that on that occasion Surya mentions something about the Buddha meaning being the kinsman of the sun, which I had a little bit of a difference of opinion with Bhikkhu Bodhi on that little point, and I opined that this was a reference to the Buddha's ancestral legend that he actually descended from the sun. Bhikkhu Bodhi thought this was a bit far-fetched. The Buddha then instructed Rahu to set them free. Rahu immediately let them go and ran to Vepachitti trembling and with stiffened hair. This incident evidently refers to the Indian myth of the eclipses, and the legend has been annexed by the Buddhists who illustrates the Buddha's power and pity. So here we have a kind of a myth of the eclipse, and no doubt that if we looked elsewhere in Indian mythology, we'd probably find the Shivites said that it was Shiva who saved the world from the eclipse, and the Vishnuites probably said it was Vishnu who saved the world from the eclipse, and etc., etc., etc. And so we have to keep up with the Joneses. So the Buddha not only teaches the Four Noble Truths and dependent origination and so on, it saves the world from eclipses. So that's good. Elsewhere, Rahu, and those suttas are quite common as paritas and probably got chanted traditionally on the occasion of eclipses. Remember, eclipses are very terrifying for people. Yeah? If you don't know what it is, it's actually very terrifying because you think the world's going to come to an end. So it's quite nice to have a little ritual you can do at that time. Elsewhere, Rahu is spoken of as the chief of those possessing Atabhava. Is the here Atabhava meaning a selfhood, something like that. Here meaning his body. The commentaries explain that he is 4,800 leagues in height, and the breadth of his chest is 1,200 yojanas.
That's slightly
big. A yojana being about 12 miles or something like that. His hands and feet are 200 leagues long. Each finger joint is 50 leagues long. The space between the eyebrows also measuring 50 leagues. His forehead is 50 years broad, and his head 900 leagues in height, etc., etc. You don't need to know all of his vital statistics. He is jealous of the gods of the sun and the moon and stands in their paths with a wide open mouth. When they fall into his mouth, the gods abandon their abodes and flee for their lives. Sometimes he caresses their abodes with his hand only, or with the lower part of his jaw, or with his tongue. Sometimes he takes them up and places them against his cheek, but he cannot stop the course of either the sun or the moon. If he attempts to do so, he will meet with disaster, so he journeys along with them. The seizure of the moon by Rahu and the escape from him is often used as a simile. Rahu is one of the four stains, or pakilesa, of the sun and the moon, preventing them from shining in all their glory. He's also one of the five causes of lack of rain, and when he gathers water into his hands and spills it into the ocean, there is no rain. Okay. To bring Rahu down from the sky is mentioned as one of the impossible tasks. There you go. It is said in the commentaries that for a long time Rahu did not visit the Buddha. He thought that being so tall he would not be able to see the Buddha. One day, however, he decided to go, and the Buddha, aware of his intentions, lay on a bed when he arrived, and by his psychic power contrived to make himself so tall that Rahu had to bend his neck to see his face. So even though the Buddha's lying down on the bed, Rahu had to look at him like that to see how tall he was. That's how big the Buddha was. Rahu confessed his folly and accepted the Buddha as his teacher. Rahu was mentioned in the Mahasamaya Sutta. It was in the assembly. When he steps into the ocean, the water of the deepest part reaches only to his knees. He's also called Verocha, which is interesting, and Bali's 100 sons were called after him, him being their uncle. Okay. The name Rahu Mukha is given to a form of torture in which the victim's mouth is forced open by a stake and fire or spikes are sent through the orifice of the ear into the mouth, which becomes filled with blood. There you go. Okay, so this is... Rahu. So, it seems... It seems that the legend of Rahu as the demon that swallows the sun and the moon, anyway, in some way it was connected with the birth of the Buddha's son, and so he was called Rahula. Whether this is purely legendary or was his actual name, it's a bit hard to say. Now, when was it? Sorry?
Interesting that we look at the Tarigatan and see what it says, what his verses are.
Yeah.
And it has some kind of mention about sometimes.
Yeah, it could do, yeah. Yeah. So there's quite a lot of suttas that with involving him and so on. And so we have a relatively large amount of information about him. Now, according to the Theravada tradition, he was born on the day that his father left the household life. Okay, so we all remember the story that the Buddha's mother, the Buddha's wife Yashodhara gives birth, and got a little baby son, and the Buddha, they're kind of sleeping there, and the Buddha pops his head in through the door and looks at them and says, bye, and runs out. So this is obviously quite kind of melodramatic kind of little episode, guaranteed to bring a tear to the eyes. You kind of visualize a poor little baby sitting there and the dad's coming off. It's very sad. Whether it actually happened in that way is not 100% certain. Now, the Mula Sarvasivada Vinaya, on the other hand, right, being perhaps less constrained by the rigors of plausibility, says that Yashodhara was actually pregnant for 7 years.
Oh.
Right? Sorry?
It's more than an elephant.
Which is more than an elephant. And,
how long was an elephant?
An elephant pregnant for 2 years?
She had 7 children?
No, she only had one child. She was pregnant with Rahula for 7 years. And when the Buddha went forth, that she kept on receiving like SMSs about what was going on in the Buddha's life. I said like him SMSs. I mean, just like kind of messages, kind of things, pigeons or something. I don't know why. But that about the Buddha's progress. Okay, and so at each stage, it's quite interesting because they actually developed so that at each stage, Yashodhara's life and spiritual development mirrored the Buddha's. So she was doing like a parallel course of spiritual development, but within the household and in a family environment, and he was doing it in the prime gone forth. So this is quite interesting, and the kind of the fruit, of course, of the Buddha's enlightenment, he sort of became enlightened, of the Buddha's practice, he became enlightened, and the fruit of the Yashodhara, well, she gave birth to Rahula. So after the extended, perhaps somewhat uncomfortable thing. So, be that as it may, so it's related in the Vinaya, and we've already read the story. Have we think we've already read the story, or are we about to read it? We've either already read.
No, I don't think we've got to that Vinaya class yet.
Yeah, anyway, in the Vinaya, the Mahavagga tells the story when the Buddha visited Kapilavastu for the first time after his enlightenment and accepted Suddhodana's invitation, Rahula's mother, Rahula Mata. And it is interesting to note that in the suttas we usually find actually just Rahula Mata, Rahula's mother, rather than a personal name for the Buddha's wife. And that's not particularly unusual that people, you know, you have seen people like Sariputta is Sari's son, or you know, and also calling the mother after the son is also quite common convention, so that's nothing particularly unusual about that. But the actual name of the Buddha's wife is actually quite uncertain. She's called different names in different contexts, so perhaps not sure quite why that's so. Perhaps it was simply the case that she was known by different names, because we know her as Yashodhara, but she's also called Bimba Devi and other things as well.
Have I seen Yashodhara?
Yashodhara? I don't know, probably in a book somewhere.
Siddhartha.
Maybe. That's probably the best known name. The Buddha gave him no answer, and at the conclusion of the meal left the palace. Rahula followed him, reiterating his request until at last the Buddha asked Sariputta to ordain him. When Suddhodana heard of this, he protested to the Buddha and asked as a boon that in future no child should be ordained without the consent of his parents, and to this the Buddha agreed.
Is this in our sutra?
No.
It's not in
the vignette.
No.
Question.
Did you read no child?
Sorry?
Did you read no child?
No child should be ordained without the consent of their parents. Yeah, good question, yeah. Or no person. Yeah, look, that's an interesting point. It certainly was given in a context of that, of children ordaining, and quite likely that actually that's really what it means, I would imagine, and that it sort of later became generalised. It'd be interesting to research that point, actually, because it seems to me it's a little bit similar to the situation we've been looking at with the Sikkhamana, where it's actually a precept originally for girls or teenagers or something, and then later becomes generalised. This may be another similar case. It'd be interesting to check that point up. Yeah.
And another interesting thing I noticed was in the ordination procedures, lacks a lot of the things that you can't ordain people, like you can't ordain a person who's had limbs cut off or whatever. And so you have all these people who can't ordain, but it's actually not mentioned in the ordination procedure, but then they ask questions like, do you have debt and all those kinds of things. But it's very interesting that they're all dukkha offences if you ordain them, but only certain ones are picked out
and
put into the ordination procedure.
But then there's a lot of others that are actually mentioned in
the
thing.
Those ones are picked out and put
in.
And there's all these other ones missing.
That is interesting, yeah. Maybe, anyway, then Rahula's mother said to Rahula the Kumara, there's your dad. Go and ask for your inheritance. And then he went to him, and he said, Sukhade Samana Chaya, monk, your shadow is pleasant. Which is quite interesting. But then a bit down here, he gave him the going forth. Okay, so then Suddhodana came to see the Blessed One, and I would ask you for one favour. Warang means like a favour or a something like that. And then I've gone beyond giving favours. Tathagatas have gone beyond giving favours. But it's allowable and blameless. So he says, go speak. Notice how he refers to his dad as Gotama. And then he says, and anyway, he goes on, he says that when the Blessed One's going forth, I had a lot of suffering. And then when Ananda went forth, it was even worse. And then Rahula, the love of sons cuts through the skin, and having cut through the skin, it cuts through the flesh, and having cut through the inner skin, having cut through the inner skin, it cuts through the flesh, having cut through the flesh, it cuts through the sinews, having cut through the sinews, it cuts through the bone, having cut through the bone, it enters into the bone marrow and stays there. It would be good if the monks, presumably, were to get the permission from their parents to give the going forth to sons without their parents' permission. So So here it says puttang. Not child or grown up, but putta. It says sons.
Which
Vinaya
is this? Is this
Vinaya? This is the Vinaya. Yeah, this is the Mahavagga. It's the same chapter we've been reading in the Vinaya classes. Yeah. And then it says you shouldn't give without going forth to a son. So maybe you can do it to a daughter, I don't know. Yeah. So that's interesting little point yet. But it certainly, you know, that's one case where I would say it certainly seems that that's what it means, doesn't it? I mean, he was supposed to be 7 years old, and you know, you don't refer to someone as a son. I mean, you probably do, but
son is.
Yeah.
To the end of time.
Sounds to the end of time. Anyway. So, that's that. Okay, so according to the commentaries, immediately after the Rahula was ordained, the Buddha preached to him constantly many suttas for his guidance. Rahula himself was eager to receive instruction from the Buddha and his teachers, and would rise early in the morning and take a handful of sand, saying, "May I have today as many words of counsel from my teachers as there are here grains of sand." The monks constantly spoke of Rahula's amenability, and one day the Buddha, aware of the subject of their talk, went amongst them and related the Tipalatamiga Jataka and the Titira Jataka to show them that in past births too Rahula had been known for his obedience. Okay, so he was recognized as the foremost in Sikha Kama, the one who's desirous of training. When Rahula was 7 years old, the Buddha preached to him the Ambalatika Rahula Ovada Sutta as a warning that he should never lie, even in fun. Rahula used to accompany the Buddha on his begging rounds, and noticing that he harbored carnal thoughts, fascinated by his own physical beauty and that of his father, the Buddha preached to him at the age of 18 the Maha Rahulavada Sutta, which is the next one. Two other suttas, also called Rahulavada, one included in the Sanyutra and one in the Anguttara, form the topics for Rahula's meditation. Later, the Buddha, knowing that Rahula's mind was ripe for final attainment, went with him alone to Andhavana and preached to him the Chula Rahulavada Sutta, at the end of which Rahula became an Arahant. Okay. So then some more. Some more details in here if you want to look them all up. Okay? So it's just a general introduction to Rahula, the Buddha's son. Thus have I heard. On one occasion the Blessed One was living at Rajagaha, in the bamboo grove of the squirrel's sanctuary. Now on that occasion the venerable Rahula was living at Ambalatika, which would seem to mean Amba is the mango, Lati is a sect, so Ambalatika, perhaps a mango grove where the sects used to gather and debate. Then, when it was evening, the Blessed One rose from meditation and went to the Venerable Rahula at Ambalatika. The Venerable Rahula saw the Blessed One coming in the distance and made a seat ready and set out water for washing the feet. The Blessed One sat down on the seat made ready and washed his feet. Venerable Rahula paid homage to him and sat down at one side. Then the Blessed One left a little water in the water vessel and asked the Venerable Rahula, "Rahula, do you see this little water left in the water vessel?" "Yes, Bhante, even so little, Rahula, is the recluseship of those who are not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie." Then the Blessed One threw away the little water that was left, then asked the Venerable Rahula, "Rahula, do you see that little water that was thrown away?" "Yes, Bhante, even so, Rahula, those who are not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie have thrown away their recluseship." Then the Blessed One turned the water vessel upside down and asked the Venerable Rahula, "Rahula, do you see this water vessel turned upside down?" "Yes, Venerable Sir, even so, Rahula, those who are not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie have turned their recluseship upside down." Then the Blessed One turned the water vessel right way up again and asked the Venerable Rahula, Rahula, do you see this hollow, empty water vessel? Yes, Bhante. Even so, hollow and empty, Rahula, is the recluse ship of those who are not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie. So, very beautiful and memorable little teaching by the Buddha there, and showing his great skill in means. He's just had his feet washed by Rahula and then takes up the water dipper used for washing the feet, and then that's his thing.
He washed his own feet.
Okay.
Like the Buddha
always does.
All right. Okay.
And it makes it even nicer when I read it. It said, "Even so, little Rahula is the recluse." And I thought, "Oh, how nice!" Well, he was only 7.
He was, yeah. So, quite a nice way to be teaching a little boy. Suppose, Rahula, there were a royal Tusker elephant with tusks as long as chariot poles, full grown in stature, high bred, and accustomed to battle. Okay, so this also, I think, is quite nicely appropriate for Rahula. Remember, he was from a kind of upper class family where they would have been surrounded by these things, and also, of course, boys are always interested in kind of war and military things and so on. So probably quite a useful simile. In battle, he would perform his task with his forefeet and his hind feet, with his forequarters and hindquarters, with his head and his ears, with his tusks and his tail, yet he would keep back his trunk. Then his rider would think, this royal tusk elephant with tusks as long as chariot poles performs his task in battle, yet he keeps back his trunk. He has not yet given up his life. But when the royal tusker elephant performs his task in battle, with his forefeet and his hind feet, with his forequarters and his hind quarters, with his head and his ears, with his tusks and his tail, and also with his trunk. Then his rider would think, this royal tusker elephant with tusks as long as chariot poles performs his task in battle also with his trunk. He has given up his life. Now there is nothing this royal tusker elephant would not do. So too, Rahula, when one is not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie, there is no evil, I say, that one would not do. Therefore, Rahula, you should train thus. I will not utter a falsehood, even as a joke. Which reminds me, there are two carrots walking along the road. But there weren't really two carrots walking along the road, were they?
I think this is where...
Is that...
Tennis or another brown get there.
That's right. Yeah, we have.
Get along on this section, on this part.
Right. Obviously based on the fact of completely objective and impersonal assessment of the nature of the textual questions involved, and nothing to do with the fact that Ajahn Brahm likes telling jokes and Ajahn Tanisara is a bit kind of stern and severe, perhaps. So, telling lies, even as a joke, means no more fun from now on.
That's terrible. That cuts off my whole thing. You mean like a bit of exaggeration is a lie?
A bit, is that right? A bit of exaggeration? Is that a lie? Is that true?
Well, when you know that it's an exaggeration.
When you know that it's an exaggeration. But when you know it's an exaggeration, what about the person listening to you?
Well, when they must know. If you use the number 800 instead of 8, they must know you're exaggerating.
Right, and I mean, if you say anything, they'd probably know that it is. Sorry, Tania, yeah.
Yeah, so a lie is if you intend to deceive the other person. Mm-hmm. But when you say something, knowing that the other person doesn't believe you, there's no intention to deceive, so it's not a lie, so jokes are okay.
Yes.
Oh, I got out of that one then. Thanks for that, Danny. I'll give Ajahn Brahm a call, by the way. He'll be good. No, that's right. So when the point is that there's an intention to create a false belief. Yeah. So it could be, like in some kind of jokes where you are sort of deliberately creating a false belief. So, for example, you might hide somebody's belongings. It's actually a pachitya offence for the bhikkhus. So you might hide someone's belongings and then they say, "Oh, where's your, where, you know, where's my bowl," or something like that, and then you might say, "Oh, I just saw such a monk walking off with it," or something like that, and then he runs after looking for it, and then you say, "Ha ha ha! I was only kidding," right? But actually, in that interim, he had the false belief that his bowl had been taken, yeah, and so that would count as telling a lie. But on the other hand, if you say, "Well, there was an Irishman, an Englishman, and a Polack," then nobody really thinks that there was an Irishman, an Englishman, and a Polack. Which reminds so in that case, you're not intending to create a false belief.
What about if you don't tell the whole truth?
Well, that's an interesting one, because you actually have to swear in court. I discussed this with a lawyer once, because we had to rewrite the oath. You know, you swear to tell the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. I mean, how can you tell the whole truth, you know? Yeah, well, first of all, there was like the Big Bang thing, and then afterwards it was... So, there's no such thing as a whole truth.
But you can leave out a lot of... I used to do that a lot.
No, because if that was the case, then in court...
And look what happened to that.
Well, the whole truth is concerning.
Yeah?
Yeah, I remember, like, in right speech, we have to know not to say the truth, but know the right time to say the truth. So we have to, like, restrain ourselves, even though we know it's correct. We have to say things when the other person's ready to receive.
Not to tell the whole truth.
Yeah, if you know that the person, like if you do tell the whole truth, the person will. Like if I tell my mom, you know what, like I'm never coming home again. That wouldn't be. I mean, let's say if I wouldn't, like, you know, that wouldn't be a useful thing to do. But I would like withhold.
There's a case in the video where the Buddha kind of doesn't tell the whole truth, where he doesn't lie. But he doesn't say, like, this person comes and asks him, "Oh, where have you seen my son?" He says, "Oh, if you just wait here for a little while, then you'll see him.
Maybe you might see him. Yeah.
So it wasn't, he actually...
Yasa and Yasa's father.
He actually used his psychic powers to make him disappear so he couldn't be seen. But actually, when he was asked a question, he said, "Oh, if you wait here for a little while, then maybe you'll see him." So he wasn't lying.
Yeah.
But he was using his speech in a way that wasn't lying.
Yeah. And that's actually a very good example, because that shows the difference between like in those kinds. Sometimes we like to think of hypothetical examples. In Buddhism, the classic case is the Lotus Sutra, where you have the simile of the burning house and the Lotus Sutra. And basically, the simile of the burning house says that there's these children in this house which is burning down, and the children are in the bottom story and the upper stories are burning down, and the children are just playing. And they don't realize that there's anything wrong. And Dad comes along and says, "Children, come out of the house." And they say,
"No.
Oh, we're happy playing by my mother." And so Dad says, "Come out of the house. I've got little toy chariots for you to play with." Right? But he doesn't actually have little toy chariots for them to play with. Then they come running out of the house to play with the chariots, and the house collapses. Meanwhile, he doesn't give them little toy chariots. He gives them real, big, expensive plush chariots for them to play with. And so the simile is that the burning house, of course, is samsara. The little children are sentient beings. The toy chariots, which are actually really an illusion and don't actually exist, is the Hinayana.
And the big...
And that's what we're doing here. Yeah. And the real plush chariots are the... Mahayana. So in other words, the Buddha only taught the Hinayana. The whole teaching of the Hinayana is actually is an expedient means to help to get people out of samsara, but it's not really true. So I find that kind of teaching very dangerous. And you know, in a similar case, if you know, in that kind of hypothetical example, you know, to follow that example, the Buddha what he would say was something like, you know, come out, you know, I will give you some chariots, rather than saying I have some chariots, come out and I'll give you some chariots, or something like that. You know, you don't have to actually phrase it as a lie. And so there's always a way to use these things skillfully. One time when I was in Perth, we used to get phone calls, rather persistent phone calls, from a certain individual who was a bit delusory anyway, and then they would ring up and ask to see a particular monk who they'd met and so on, and who they regarded was an arahant who was reading their minds and so on and so forth. And so this went on for some time, and we tried talking with the person, counselling them and so on and so forth, and eventually it just got too much. So whenever they would ring up, because I was the secretary, so I'd answer the phone. So they'd ring up and I'd answer the phone, and when I knew it was them, and then the monk would jump up and run out of the room, and then I'd say, "Oh, I'm sorry, he's just left." Is it true? And after we did that 3 or 4 times, I think she got the message. So.
He's not in the room right now.
He's not in the room right now, yeah. He's just left. So perhaps not the best thing to do, but what can you do sometimes? So what do you think, Rahul? What is the purpose of a mirror? I should have the Pali. I haven't got the Pali for that. What is the purpose of a mirror? Yeah?
That's what leads us out is our own experience, right? I mean, that we see the results of the practice which keeps us going, which is the carrot. So, I mean, just teachings and it can't really get us anywhere. So is that the way to think about, I don't know what Hinayana is, but the path leading us to Nirvana?
As being like a carrot?
Yeah, they carry our own
ideas.
With all the results of the practice?
Hinayana, teachings? I'm not sure what that's got to do with Hinayana.
I don't know, because it's Hinayana leads us out, but isn't it?
No, okay, yeah.
It doesn't understand because you said.
Okay. Hinayana means the crappy vehicle. Okay. Hina is the past participle of jah, which I won't try to explain the derivation of, and jah meaning to throw, and so hina means thrown away. Okay, literally, so it means crap, basically, and it's always
used.
It never means small. Okay, hina never means small. It's translated in that way because it seems that one of the Chinese translators, who may have been Kumarajiva, if I'm not mistaken, was translating suttas into Chinese, but perhaps either felt that it was a bit inelegant to translate it literally, or perhaps felt some sympathy for Hinayana, and so translated it in a way that made it look less pejorative. So he translated it, and then that sort of circulated around and got picked up into English usage from there. So the actual meaning definitely means crappy. Hina is never... Maha is as big, or is always contrasted with chula as small.
Yeah.
So it's big and small. So hina is contrasted with panita, where panita means superior, and hina means crappy or inferior. Yeah. So just to clarify that, is that when the Mahayana emerged, that, as is very, very typical for young and new movements, that it felt somewhat very kind of defensive and a bit neurotic, and it needed to kind of differentiate itself from the schools from which it felt that it was reforming. And so it's quite a lot of the Mahayana sutras, not all of them, but quite a number of them are very polemical and quite aggressive, quite shrill in their kind of attacks and denunciations of the early schools of Buddhism. And when they do those attacks, they typically use either one of two words. One word is Shravakayana, which means the disciples' vehicle, to refer to the early schools. And so that's a relatively polite, that's probably from a Mahayana perspective is slightly slightly kind of looking down their noses a little bit, because they believe that they're the Bodhisattva-yana, is the vehicle of the Bodhisattvas. But it's a relatively polite term, but then when they were not concerned about being polite, they would use the term Hinayana, which means crappy vehicle. And so that was a pejorative term used solely by the Mahayanists to describe and criticize the early schools of Buddhism. Now, those early schools of Buddhism which they were talking about, in most cases, were quite probably the Sarvastivadins, okay? Probably not always, because the Mahayanists would have been in contact with early Buddhists in different schools in different places, but often it seems what they're referring to is the Sarvastivadins. In modern times, that criticism then became applied to the Theravadins of Sri Lanka, which is actually quite... Anyway, it's not at all obvious that it's a historically accurate usage of the word. Xuanzang, in the 7th century, remarked on finding many places, many large communities of what he called Mahayana Staviras. It's like the Theravadan Mahayanists, okay? So it's not at all clear that there was an actual meaningful distinction between Theravada and Mahayana and how these words have been used in the old days. It may well be that many people from early schools simply believed in and practiced the Bodhisattva path, and they could be called in one sense Mahayanists, as there are today. There are many people, many well-known monks and so on, who believe in and practice the Bodhisattva path in Theravada today. It's just a bit unfortunate that kind of pejorative term became adopted, and a lot of the times even the Theravadins don't actually know what it means, so the Theravadins will use it of themselves and say we're Theravada. I mean, I heard where this kind of classic interview once with a Thai monk in Melbourne. This was years ago, and the interviewer asked him, "Oh, do you have much to do?" There's another Thai temple. Do you have much to do with them? He says, "Oh, no, not really. We're Hinayana and they're Theravada," or something like that, which kind of shows the amount that people know or understand what these terms mean. Actually, the use of the word Hinayana was officially declared to be not politically correct. In the, what is it, World Buddhist something something something, I can't remember, World Fellowship of Buddhists agreement they made, I think, in the 50s. So it's officially declared to be not an appropriate usage. And knowledgeable Buddhists, like, say, the Dalai Lama or so on, would always use Shravakayana. So if we want to refer to the early Buddhist schools as a whole, okay, including the Theravada and the 18, so-called other 18 schools, then we would use the term Shravakayana, okay? And so Shravakayana is not a school, it's a movement, okay? It's a broad-based movement including many schools. Similarly, Mahayana is not a school as such. Mahayana is a movement which encompasses many different schools of thought, okay? But the unifying principle was the emphasis on the Bodhisattva path. That's what identified the Mahayana. So, to sum up that if we want to refer to the specifically Sri Lankan school these days, we use Theravada. Historically, we'd probably best to use the Mahaviharavasan. It's the dwellers in the great monastery. The term for the early schools as a whole is probably best to use Shravakayana. And the term Hinayana is best left in a somewhat embarrassed silence as much as possible.
It's like what the Protestants call the other, I guess.
What do they call the others?
I don't know.
Yeah, well, they did. I mean, a lot of them were, like, for example, the Quakers. There was another pejorative term there, because they were all kind of shaking and so on, so they called them the Quakers, and then it became adopted as a...
to come to the other end. So you need the strong vehicle, because you are going to live long, long, long time to come to that end. I thought that's why they say Tinian and Mahayana.
Yeah, well, that would make sense if it was really a small vehicle, but it's not really a small vehicle.
Because you go quickly and they finish it.
But it doesn't mean a small vehicle means a crappy vehicle.
No, it doesn't mean
it means a 1979 Toyota Corona.
Yeah, by that time it's a new one. When you're using it, it's new. By others go to that, then
Sigma, yeah, Sigma, yeah.
It's like that. Yes, you go few years early, and they have to wait long, long, long time. So by that time, that vehicle is old anyway. But the other's gone, left and gone. It's antique.
So they need the engineer to keep it going.
That's a
125. That's a 125. Daniel.
Isn't just the vehicle, not the Eightfold Path, and restraining the fallen desires, contentment, and all that, isn't that just what takes us to?
That's the Hinayana, yeah.
And that's, you know, the whole path.
Yes.
So what's all this complicated
thing? Okay, well...
I guess I'm not going to try to understand, yeah? It's too much?
No, you can try to understand, that's good.
Just
resign yourself to failure. No, but the... It's all to do with the polemics and discussions in the schools. Remember, when we were talking about Indian Buddhism, we're talking about a massive movement over, you know, dozens of what we would consider nations over 1,500 years. Okay, so you know, there's a huge variety of different opinions, approaches, and so on and so forth. Yeah, and Mahayana was an important part of that whole movement. Now, if you take the Mahayana scriptures seriously, okay, then you know, one of the problems is that the Mahayanas traditionally would insist that the Mahayana sutras were literally spoken by the Buddha. Of course, they weren't, right? And that's historically not even a serious hypothesis. Okay, we know that they didn't appear till the earliest ones, 400 or 500 years after the Buddha, and up to another 1,000 years after that. Okay. So there's no serious grounds for thinking that they were spoken by the Buddha. But what they do is that they reflect the conditions in the Sangha and in the Buddhist community at the time when they were written. Okay, and they adopt the form of a sutta because they're backdating to the time of the Buddha. So often the Mahayana sutras will criticize various aspects of the early, what they call Hinayana. Okay. And but those criticisms don't make sense at all when you consider that in the light of the suttas. Okay, so for example, if they say the Hinayana is selfish and lacking compassion, then of course that's got no basis in the suttas, because in the suttas are talking about compassion all the time. So so traditionally, what the Theravadins would do is just dismiss it and say, therefore, it's just not true, didn't happen, and we don't have to pay any attention to it. But actually, if we listen to it a bit more sympathetically, then what it's probably saying is that at the time when they were written, that there was this problem, for example, where a lot of the monks maybe became very selfish, okay, and where they maybe were living in their big monasteries where they had a lot of wealth and so on, and they didn't do anything to help people and so on and so forth, and that the critiques in the Mahayana Sutras are directed to those monks living at that time. And so if you understand it as a social comment and a social critique, which is valid in a certain historical context, then we can see, well, it actually has some basis. Yeah, and so that's why I think it's much more useful to understand them historically rather than, you know, I don't think it's right to just dismiss these things out of hand just because they happen to be later. Right, then we can't learn from them.
And like the monks, they complain about the monks in the monastery, they contemplate the nature of the aggregates. And
Yeah. That's very interesting. The Sandhi Niramochana Sutra. It takes us a little bit off our track to go look at those things in more detail now, but partly the early Mahayana partly seemed a bit like the forest tradition as a kind of a response to an overly domesticated academic kind of Buddhism. Anyway. I think I will need the light now. I'm getting a bit tired to read.
If you light up the writing again, can I ask about one word which occurs six times and it's Pachavekitva?
Pachavekitva. Well, thank you very much for that, Eva.
It occurs six times in the bottom sentence.
This is precisely why I opened up this file so we can look at this, so we can look at this word. So, what do you think? Rahula, what is the purpose, kim atta, of a mirror? Pachavekanato bhanteti. That's for the purpose of reflection. Okay? So this word here, just break it up into bits. Pachaveka is actually the actual, if we can break it up here, it's pachaveka. I think it's Pati-a-ve-ava-ika-na. So it breaks up something like that. So this is atto. The N is a sandhi consonant, so that's just a bit of gap filler that sticks the two elements together. Right? Doesn't mean anything. Eka is ika, which means to see or to look at something. Okay, just ika is the same as ocular. Okay, the same root as English ocular. Ika. And here we have ava. And so what this should be actually is ava, right? But we learnt at our lesson the other week is that a plus, oops, a plus, oops, where am I? Oh God, sorry. A plus I equals
E.
Okay. So A plus I equals E. So we take out the, so this should be Ika and this should be Ava, but when we take out those two elements and add them together, of Eka. So the lost A, in other words, the lost A is still reflected or still heard in the E sound there. And then Pa Cha is actually pati. This is actually a prefix, pati. Pa.
Ika is one, isn't it?
Ika is one. No, that's eka.
Eka.
That's eka, yeah. Eka.
That's P-A-double-C, pa.
Yeah.
That's on one of the, on the left hand page.
Yeah.
Or something. One of our pages.
Uh-huh.
I can't remember how it's
used. Okay. But there it is. Yep, pati sankha, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. So pati is a very common prefix, and pati just means re, or it's equivalent to the English re or anti, as in reaction or antimatter or something like that. And here has become assimilated there, and this is quite a common form that pati becomes pach. We actually discussed similar changes in the Pali class last week as well, with the S becoming, you remember that, with the S becoming double C and stuff like that?
Yeah.
So here, pati plus the, because basically because the I, it's basically because when the I is added to the A here, and then, and because you've got an A, then these two get assimilated. So basically what you have is T plus I, DI, D becomes, equals double C. TI equals, oops, equals double C. So TI, T plus I equals double C. Ja. So the process there is that TI becomes, it's actually kind of a dialectical process, becomes TY. Ja. Because I is very similar in sound to Y, yeah? Tia, ti, yeah, it's found at the same place in the mouth. Tia, tia, tia. So if you say tia, chaga, chaga, and chaga, for example, tiaga, chaga, sound very similar. Yeah? So then that becomes CC. Tiaga, chaga. Alright? So that's how that form comes about. So if we were to spell it all out, we'd have, I should have left it there. Pati, pa,
If you were doing an exam,
Pati, hang on, Eva. Pati, and then Ava, and then Ika, and then Ata. So let's see how the compound breaks up. Pati is re, Ava literally means down. Okay, it's a prefix meaning down. Although prefixes in Pali always have a very general kind of meaning, okay? So they can mean many things in different contexts, and or nothing, okay? And they can have even opposite meanings. So you just have to look in context. Other ika is a very common idiom to look down. It's the same as Avalokiteshvara, is the one who looks down. So this is kind of a common idiom, probably doesn't mean, the downness of it doesn't mean all that much, really. So ava pati is re, ava down, ika look, and then for the purpose. So pachavekana is the, is to reflection, and here the pati especially means the re, as in that reflection. I was wrong before when I said that the N is a sandhi consonant. That's actually part of the noun, but ekana. Ika meaning something like look, and ekana or ikana meaning looking. The looking back down or something like that. So that's actually part of the word. Okay? Any questions?
If you reflection. Were doing a test on Pali, would you be asked to do that?
Yes, of course. Yep.
Would you?
Yep.
Could you translate Avalokiteshvara?
Avalokiteshvara, I'll put it up here. Avalokiteshvara, it's in Sanskrit. In Pali, it would be Ava or O. How are you there? Ishvara or Isvara is basically means God. Okay, so Ishvara is the word that they use for the Creator God. So if you're going to find an Indic term that you would use for God with a capital G. You would use Isara or Ishvara as the closest thing that they have. Ava Lokita means to look down. So it's the Lord who looks down on the world. Okay. Now there are certain. I'm just trying to remember now. There are certain ambiguities. I think especially in this second element here. Ava Lokiteshvara. In how it's formed in the Sanskrit, and then you can come to different meanings. I'm just trying to think. Oh, yeah, that's right. One of the you can come to different meanings of it depending on how you interpret it. So Ishvara almost certainly means Ishvara is the Lord, but Shvara also means sound. Okay, and so here if you can translate as the Lord who looks down on the world, so it's like the Lord who's sort of surveying the world, but if you understand Shvara as meaning sound and Lokita as meaning not to look down but as the world itself, okay, so it means something like listening to the cries of the world, something like that, yeah? So either the Lord who looks down or the one who listens to the cries of the world. So that's how they translate Quan Shu Yin. This is where the yin means to listen, isn't it? Is that right? Sound, yeah? So this is where that translation comes from, is from interpreting Swara as meaning sound. In fact, it's from Isara, meaning Lord.
Quan is observe.
Observe, is it?
I can say, Su Quan is like...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Quan is Quan.
Like metta.
Yeah.
Meditation.
India,
in India, they have
yeah.
What they call Ishvara temples.
Ishvara temples, yeah. I think it's usually Shiva, isn't it? I think Shiva is usually Ishvara, yeah. So. Okay. so for the purpose of reflection, so for the purpose of looking back at oneself. So it's nice, again, this sutta is giving us a very nice, clear example, and you know, you can see how the Buddha is quite nicely through this sutta using the similes to work from like a material basis, you know, in teaching Rahula as a child, working from a material basis and then as a metaphor for mental qualities, yeah. So what's a mirror for? So you start out with a mirror, he knows what a mirror is for, and then he can lead him on. The same with the cup, yeah? You start with something physical, you can lead him on. So this is quite nice. So someone was asking the other day about the teaching methods for children, and this gives some quite nice examples here. So too, Rahula, an action with the body should be done after repeated reflection. An action by speech should be done after repeated reflection. An action by mind should be done after repeated reflection. So here, this is why Eva pointed out that the it's used so many times here. Pachavekitva is repeated reflection. Actually, they literally just repeat the word. Pachavekitva vachaya kamankatabang. Pachavekitva manasa kamankatabang. Okay. Rahula, when you wish to do an action with the body, you should reflect on that same body thus. So now it's good, this is giving how you actually do the reflection. Would this action that I wish to do with the body lead to my own affliction or to the affliction of others or to the affliction of both? Is it an unwholesome bodily action with painful consequences, with painful results? When you reflect, if you know this action that I wish to do with my body would lead to my own affliction or to the affliction of others or to the affliction of both, it is an unwholesome bodily action with painful consequences and painful results, then you definitely should not do such an action with the body. But when you reflect, if you know this action that I wish to do with the body would not lead to my own affliction or to the affliction of others or to the affliction of both, it is a wholesome bodily action with pleasant consequences, pleasant results, then you may do such an action with the body. So here the word affliction is vyapada, and vyapada, interesting. So that's general term meaning affliction or something similar to suffering. And notice that the meaning or the context in which a good or bad action is discussed is in terms of what's its result. Okay, if an act leading to suffering, then it's a akusala act. Okay, this is akusala. This is akusalang idang kaya kamang dukha drayang dukha vipakanti. Okay, so akusalang, this is akusala with results in suffering, and on the other hand, the kusala, which results in happiness. Okay, so this is a what they call utilitarian approach to ethics. Okay, so the utilitarian philosophy in Western philosophy was first articulated by John Stuart Mill, I think, in the 19th century, and basically said that whatever is good is what leads to happiness. Okay, so whatever choice leads to the greatest happiness, balance of happiness over pain, is good. Okay, so this here, the Buddha is articulating a utilitarian ethical theory. And the other point worth making here is that this pattern that we find, it says this act with the body, atta vyapada, for oneself, for others, and for ubhaya, for both. Okay, and so again, this relating to the point I made earlier that the argument that early Buddhism is selfish is quite ridiculous, because we find these kinds of formulations time and time again. The good, looking for the good for oneself, the good for others, and the good for both. Okay, so you start out with the good for yourself, because this is what we're actually concerned about. Then you learn to extend that to others, and in the end you realize the good for myself is really bound up with the good for others, and there's not really any difference between them anyway. Okay, and so that's actually the position of early Buddhism, not, as it's often presented, to say that we're only concerned about ourselves and not concerned about others.
You'd save this up for a really big action. You couldn't just do it all day.
Uh-huh.
Look at everything you're doing. You know.
Right, so you say, should I pick up that glass of water? Now, is it going to be... That's very true. And That's also showing that the meaning of karma, meaning action, is a bit more weighty than just anything that you happen to be doing. Okay, so a karma is really something that's ethically has some ethical potency or ethical weight to it. Now, if I decide whether to drink a cup of water or not, then that has some very little, you know, meaning. It's just because I'm thirsty and have a drink of water. On the other hand, if I pick it up and decide to throw it at one of the monks, then that's something I definitely should reflect about beforehand, yeah? Because it has consequences.
What about catching a bus or a train? That's just a normal...
All those kind of normal things, yeah.
Normal.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it might have ethical consequences in terms of, well, what's the purpose that you're doing for, and so on and so forth,
like
right?
Meat consumption.
Sorry?
Like meat consumption.
Like meat consumption or these kinds of things. So it might do, but it's not... You know, every little thing, every time you have to open a door, you have to stop and say, hang on, is this kusa or is this akusa?
I guess anything you feel has a negative thing in it.
Especially not when you're driving, okay? Do I change? Is this akusa or akusa? Should I stop at this red light? Is this just do it and worry about the reflection afterwards, okay?
Yeah, yeah. You get to the reflection afterwards, which is...
Yeah. Okay. So this is before you're doing it. Then while you're doing it, you should reflect on it while you're doing it, okay? And then after you've done the action with the body, then you also do that same thing. Now, if also it says here, after you've done it, if you know that it was in fact akusala, so here is the kattu kamo. So here's the first one, kattu kamo, desiring to do. So when you wish to do an action, kattu, to do. Infinitive, karma, wishing. Here is karantena, by one. This is instrumental and this is a present participle. So it's while you're doing it. And then finally, katwa, the gerund, is having done it. Having done the action.
That's the second time that word's happened.
Hmm. Having done it, then it's no unit suffering, and then that such a act, you should confess it or declare it to your teacher or to a intelligent companions in the holy life, should open it up, make it clear, and having opened it up and made it clear and declared it, then you should restrain yourself in the future. Okay, so this is what, of course, the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis do each fortnight with confessing our offences for each other, to each other.
What's apajitabham?
Means to attain. Someone that wants you to attain restraint in the future.
Except for the confession form that they do these days, it's not open, not clear, and yeah, it's not open or clear.
Anyway, but if it is kusala, then teneva tuang rahula, then rahula, piti pamo jena, with rapture and joy, vihareyasi, you should dwell by day and by night, by day and by night, aho ratta nusikhi, training yourself in wholesome dhammas. Okay? So this is the Buddha's very positive and inspiring approach to ethics. So when you do something wrong, not to... So, you know, it's interesting like that it's not actually symmetrical, is it? So you do something good, you're supposed to be happy about it, but he doesn't say when you do something bad, you should be sad about it. Yeah? Interesting. When you do something bad, you should open it up and declare it and clear it out and get rid of it. And when you do something good, then you should remember it, keep it, and then be happy. That's not symmetrical. And then, of course, the same thing goes through for acts of speech and acts of the mind. Okay?
But when you declare a wrong thing, you aren't all that tickled pink about doing it, are you?
Not tickled actually pink at that time, no.
You feel a bit crummy.
You feel a little... You feel a bit crummy, yeah. Well, if you're packaged in the crummy vehicle, then you're probably okay.
But the sense of relief is a joyous thing.
Yeah.
The relief of putting the burden of the Hiriota put down, sort of like you've declared it and it's
you made it.
It's kind of joy.
It is. It is nice. It's a bit like the kind of joy from like cleaning the house. You know, it's kind of hard work and you get kind of dirty and it's unpleasant, but actually it feels good to get it out. So, Evie, of course, I should talk about something you've had actual experience with.
I'll tell you what. I left my husband and I was really happy. But it wasn't such a good thing, was it? I mean, was it ethical?
I think it was.
Yeah?
I shouldn't say that.
In that case, I
think. Perhaps it's like when one was a Catholic and one realizes, and then gives up Catholicism and realizes, oh, I don't have Catholic guilt anymore.
Not quite that simple. Then it's programmed into your brain. Okay. Rahula. Whatever Samanas and Brahmins in the past, Atita Madhana. Okay, so Atita means literally past, as in it has gone already, gone past.
I've lost it.
We're now on page 526, paragraph 18. Whatever recluses and Brahmins in the past purified their bodily action, their verbal action, and their mental action, all did so by repeatedly reflecting thus. Whatever recluses and Brahmins in the future will purify their bodily action, their verbal action and mental action, all will do so by repeatedly reflecting thus. Whatever recluses and Brahmins in the present are purifying their bodily action, their verbal action and their mental action, all are doing so by repeatedly reflecting thus. Okay. So here the Buddha are talking about the universality of this process, and again just notice that when in this kind of formulation in the Pali, this is actually a useful way of telling of learning or noting the different grammatical styles, okay, because we know that the different tenses, because in the past is parisodhesum, is the aorist plural for they did in the past, parisodhesum, parisodhesanti, they will do, and parisodenti, they do purify, they have purified, they will purify, they are purifying.
We haven't done that in the grammar, no.
In Pali they use the past, future and then present, rather than we use the past, present and future.
Right,
so yeah. Same in this case.
Yep.
Right. They have in the past.
Yeah.
And
they will.
Will.
In the future.
Yeah.
And then come back in the present. Yeah. It's interesting that it kind of expresses a different relationship to time, doesn't it? Yeah. In the Western way of looking at it, so you say past, present and future, so you're actually moving into the future. Whereas in the Indian way of doing it, you're actually moving back into the present. It's quite interesting. That's what is the basis of what they call the Vyakarana philosophy. There's like a whole philosophy in India based on grammar, and they kind of drew quite profound conclusions from details like that. Tasmatiha Rahula Pachavekita. Therefore, Rahula, you should repeatedly purify your acts of body, speech, and mind. Evang hivo rahula sikhita bandhati. I think there's a misspelling there. But that's how you should train. Okay? So this is the kind of exhortation at the end for rahula. So took a little while to do that sutta, so we won't go on to the next sutta this today.
The line there is very, we've seen it often, Idama Vocha
Bhagavan. Idama Vocha, yeah. Once or twice?
What's it say? I've forgotten.
And that's what it said.
Thus was said. Avocha is an aorist. Said the best one.
You don't want to do the next one?
No. I haven't got time.
Okay.
Any more questions? Where are we going? Where are we close?
Who else was there to remember this sutta, to write it down?
Who else was there to remember it?
Besides Buddha and Rahula.
Well, this is the interesting question, because, of course, traditionally Ananda was supposed to be present, and if he wasn't present, the sutta was supposed to be repeated to him. That was the deal. Okay, so the Buddha was supposed to repeat all of his suttas to Ananda so that he would know them afterwards. But this particular sutta, if it was really told to Rahula when he was only 7, Ananda clearly didn't ordain until 15 years after that. So how he learnt about it, not really sure. Maybe Rahula remembered it and then mentioned it again, or... But yeah.
15 years after that?
Yep.
Why?
Because Ananda didn't ordain until after the 20th reign, so Buddha's 20th vasa.
Mm-hmm. And this is the 5th, right? This is about the 5th when he went back to the palace.
It must be, I mean, if the 7-year age, I mean, okay, so the chronology of this period is uncertain, as you might have guessed. If the Buddha went forth at, what did he go forth at? 29, and then practiced for
six
years. Then in the 7th year he returned to Kapalavatthu. Okay? No. In at 36, 7th year after he left home, he returned back to Kapalavatthu. Then at that age Rahula would have been 7. So that must be the chronology which says why Rahula is 7 at that time he went forth, and at the time that sutta was taught. Now whether that's actually the case is uncertain. There's no particular reason. It does seem that the Buddha visited Kapalavatthu shortly after his enlightenment. Whether it was actually, you know, in the year next year is not certain, although it's not implausible. There's no reason why he shouldn't have. But the really problematic thing is that, according to the commentary, is that, and the traditional chronology tells us that Ananda and the other Sakyan princes also went forth at that time. Now, in fact, it's actually quite interesting, because in that dialogue, Suddhodana, I hadn't noticed that before, he actually mentions Ananda's going forth. So that's quite interesting. In any case, we know from Ananda's Theragata verses. So, just for a bit of background, is we have a set of verses, okay? One called the Theragata, the Therigata, giving the verses of the monks and the nuns, okay? And those verses are supposed to represent the actual words of those monks and nuns themselves. And generally speaking, there's no reason why they shouldn't be, okay? And especially when we see some kinds of information, like in Ananda's verses, which seem to go against the mainstream interpretation, then that's evidence that they maybe are authentic, okay? This is a principle of text criticism, is that the minority voice often is more plausible. And in that case, Ananda says that, I think he says that, what did he say? I think he says exactly that I think 25 years went past after my going forth before I reached arahantship, something like that. And so we know that he reached arahantship after the Buddha passed away, okay? So that 25 years must refer to about a period after about 20 years after the Buddha's awakening. The Buddha taught for 45 years. Okay. So just let me finish off. But so that implies that Ananda probably went forth about 20 years, because it says in the Vinaya that he attained stream entry in the first year, his first vasa, after he went forth. So from that chronology, it seems quite plausible that Ananda went forth after the Buddha's awakening 20 years, became a stream enterer, and then lived and practiced as a stream enterer for 25 years before attaining full enlightenment shortly after the Buddha passed away. And that that chronology kind of makes sense also when considering Ananda's age, because again, according to the commentary, Ananda was supposed to be the same age as the Buddha. But it seems very unlikely that that was the case. In almost every reference we have to Ananda, he certainly seems as if he's much younger than the Buddha. In fact, he seems he's treated right throughout the suttas basically as being like the Buddha's son, in that kind of role. And I think clearly he was a generation younger than the Buddha, so he would have been 20 to 30 years younger than the Buddha. Okay, so probably a similar age to Rahula. So it's difficult to reconcile all of the chronology, but it does seem as if Ananda was considerably younger. So sorry, Ananda.
I think that the enlightenment of Ananda is, I don't think that's sure, because it's a later thing that's been added in from the account of the first council, and the account of the first council has some iffy things in it itself.
Yeah.
So then it's something that's passed the Buddha already, not in the in Ananda's own words, and put in at the end, and then he, after no long time, went forth and blah 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 and attained enlightenment. It was actually not put in the person his own words. I don't know, maybe it is, but it's a later thing. The first council is not actually
for sure
part of the vignette. It's been added to the end of the vignette.
For sure, yeah. I'm not sure if it's also in his Theragata verses.
I don't know.
I think it might also be in the Theragata verses, which may be where it got from. I mean, I take your point is absolutely correct, that the fact that it's a detail found in the first council does not by itself show that it's necessarily the case. Although, it's a bit difficult. There doesn't seem to be anything to contradict it, and it does certainly seem to be a widespread... No, it's not found. And, it's probably being an under, he's probably got stacks of verses here. Blah 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 blah. So Putta, okay. So this is Ananda's verses. Here we go. Pasa Chitta Katang Bimbang. There you go. See that bimbo? That's what it says. Don't blame me. Okay. Bahusuto chitta kathi buddhasa paricharako panna baharo visanyuto. Gautama makes his bed. This is probably referring to the thing of his where he lay down and became enlightened while he was lying down. So that's probably what that's originated from. Seyankapeti, one makes his bed. Gautama, you're referring to Ananda himself, having laid down the burden and being freed from fetters. Okay, the Bahusutto, much learned, Chittakati, of varied speech, Buddhasa Paricharako, the attendant of the Buddha, and having laid down the burden and being freed from fetters, the Gautama makes his bed. Kiyanasavo, being freed of defilements, freed from fetters, Sangatito, overcome bonds, Sunnibuto, well nibbanaed, carrying the last birth and having reached, carrying the last body and having reached the end of birth. Just trying to find the so anyway, he's definitely The verses definitely say that he's an arahant. I'm just trying to see about the, if it says anything about the timing there. Huh? Where? Which one?
How many
time, yeah. Why do you say that? Where are you looking?
Is it inside here?
I don't know. I'm just trying to find it. It does say something somewhere. I'm not sure. I can't remember exactly how it phrases it, so I'm not quite sure what I'm looking for. Probably says something about Vasa, doesn't it? Here we go. Anavisati, for 25 years I was a seka. So that means he was not fully enlightened for 25 years. Okay, now here, this is interesting here. Blah, 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 blah. For 25 years I was a seka. Okay, so I was a trainee on the path to enlightenment. And I had no perceptions of sensuality arose. See the good nature of the Dhamma or something like that. So it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because he had all this stuff around nuns and women and things like this, and then he's saying, "That karma sanya, I didn't have any sensual desire arise." Actually, according to the I think Chinese tradition, there's all this kind of thing about him wanting to run off and get married and stuff like that. So and then this repeats for 25 years. I was a seka, and not desa sanya. Okay, so I didn't have any perceptions of country. So this is an interesting one. Not desa sanya.
So he wasn't Thai, or he wasn't Burmese.
Yeah, and he wasn't kind of interesting. Maybe kind of an oblique reference to the fact that he's from the Buddha's clan. And so there may have been some, maybe some kind of feeling about that, this Sangha is dominated by all these Sakyans from, and there may be kind of a political thing, and he's saying, no, it's nothing to do with that nationalism or anything like that. And he was followed by metta, like a shadow that never leaves, acts of body, speech and mind. Buddhasa, when the Buddha was walking, I followed along behind him. And he was teaching me until the Dhamma knowledge arose. Along hung sakaraniyom hi. Okay, so I have done. I am one who still has something to do. Okay, I'm a seka, appamattamanaso, who is diligent in mind. But I still have something to do. In other words, he's not enlightened yet. Sattuca parinibbanam, and the teacher has parinibbanad, who was so kind to me. Okay, so this is obviously referring to the time of the Buddha's enlightenment. So he's clearly stating that he was not fully enlightened at the time of the Buddha's parinibbana.
So it must be that Rahula went far from much later than. Not 7 years
if
after the Buddha
tangent,
or after the
fourth day. Yeah, that's quite interesting, isn't it? I'll have to double check that. And Alio's got an essay about the chronology of all that. I'm not sure if he noticed that reference. I'd have to double check that. Yeah.
It's a bit hard for him to be his son as well if he's 7 years old and then he comes back much later. Or gets kind of mixed.
If he's 7 years old, yeah. So he would, if that was the case, if it was really after, he would really have been 20 when he went four.
Can I say something back to the sutta we've just done?
Yeah.
That it's such a good sutta where Buddha teaches important things to a child.
Mm-hmm.
That perhaps it was a common one that he might use with children that age, and therefore.
Yep.
Ananda could have quite easily heard it many times.
That's quite likely, yeah.
Written it as Rahula thing because of who he was.
Yep. Quite likely that's quite true. It may well have been a standard teaching, especially for the novices, to give them some very clear instructions in their ethical conduct, yeah.
How to control a little voice sometimes.
No playing. Thank you.